One side was splintered and black. Several of the branches on that side still smoldered sullenly, like the ashes of a carelessly doused campfire. Rosie was afraid to climb over it. Gouges and splinters and jags of wood stuck up all over the burst trunk. She began edging around it on the right, where the roots had torn out of the ground. She had gotten most of the way back to the path when one of the tree's roots suddenly jerked, quivered, then slid around her upper thigh like a dusty brown snake. "Hey, baby, wanna do the dog? Wanna do the dog, you bitch?" The voice came drifting out of the crumbling, dry cave of earth where the tree had so recently stood. The root slid higher on her thigh. "Wanna put all four on the floor, Rosie? That sound good? I'll be your backdoor man, gobble you like a toasted cheese sandwich. Or would you rather suck my AIDS infected?" "Let me go," Rosie said quietly, and pressed the crumpled wad of her nightgown against the root that was holding her. It loosened and fell away immediately. She hurried the rest of the way around the tree and resumed the path. The root had squeezed hard enough to leave a red ring on her thigh, but the mark faded quickly. She supposed she should have been terrified by what had just happened, that perhaps something meant for her to be terrified. If so, it hadn't worked. She decided that this was a pretty cut-rate chamber of horrors, all in all, for someone who had lived with Norman Daniels for 14 years. Another 5 minutes brought her to the end of the path. It opened into a perfectly circular clearing, and within it was the only living thing in all this desolation. It was the most beautiful tree Rosie had ever seen in her life, and for several moments she actually forgot to breathe. She had been a faithful attendee of Methodist Little Folk Sunday School back in Aubreyville, and now she remembered the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and thought that if there really had been a tree of good and evil standing at the center of that place, it must have looked just like this. It was densely dressed in long, narrow leaves of polished green, and its branches hung heavy with a perfect bounty of reddish-purple fruit. The falls surrounded the tree in a rose-madder drift which exactly matched the color of the short gown worn by the woman Rosie hadn't dared to look at. Many of these falls were still fresh and plump. They had probably been struck from the tree in the storm which had just passed. Even those well advanced in rot looked almost unbearably sweet. Rosie's mouth cramped pleasurably at the thought of picking up one of those fruits and biting deeply into it. She thought the taste would be both tart and sweet, something like a stalk of rhubarb picked early in the morning, or raspberries taken from the bush the day before they came to perfect ripeness. As she looked at the tree, one of the fruits, to Rosie it looked no more like a pomegranate than it looked like a bureau drawer, dropped from an overloaded branch, struck the ground, and split open in rose-madder folds of flesh. She could see the seeds amid its trickling juices. Rosie took a step toward the tree and stopped. She kept swinging back and forth between two poles, her mind's belief that all this had to be a dream, and her body's equally emphatic assertion that it couldn't be, that no one on earth had ever had a dream this real. Now, like a troubled compass needle caught in a landscape where there are too many mineral deposits, she swung doubtfully back toward the dream thesis. Standing to the left of the tree was something that looked like a subway entrance. Broad white steps led down into darkness. Above them was an alabaster plinth upon which a single word had been carved. Maze. "Really, this is too much," Rosie thought. But she walked toward the tree just the same. If this was a dream, it couldn't hurt to follow instructions. Doing so might even hasten the moment when she finally woke up in her own bed, groping for the alarm clock, wanting to silence its self-righteous yell before it could split her head open. How she would welcome its cry this time. She was chilly, her feet were dirty, she had been groped by a root and ogled by a stone boy who, in a properly made world, would have been too young to know what the hell he was looking at. Most of all, she felt that if she didn't get back to her room soon, she was apt to come down with a really wonderful cold, maybe even bronchitis. That would take care of her date on Saturday and keep her out of the recording studio all next week as well. Not seeing the absurdity of believing one could become ill as the result of an excursion made in a dream, Rosie knelt down just beyond the fallen fruit. She surveyed it carefully, wondering again how it would taste. Like nothing you found in the produce aisle of the A&P, that was for sure. Then unfolded a corner of her nightgown. She tore off another chunk, wanting to provide herself with a square of cloth and succeeding better than she had expected to do. She laid it down, then began to pick seeds up off the ground, placing each one on the cloth she intended using to carry them. A good plan, too, she thought. Now, if I only knew why I was carrying them. The tips of her fingers went numb right away, as if they had been shot full of Novocaine. At the same time, the most wonderful aroma filled her nose, sweet but not flowery. It made Rosie think of the pies, cakes, and cookies that had come from her grandma's stove. It made her think of something else as well, something which was light years from Grandma Weeks's kitchen with its faded linoleum and Currier and Ives prints, of how she had felt when Bill's hip brushed against hers as they were walking back to the corn building. She laid 2 dozen seeds on the square of cloth, hesitated, shrugged, and added 2 dozen more. Would that be enough? How could she know when she didn't know what they were for to begin with? In the meantime, she'd better be moving. She could hear the baby again, but the cries were now little more than echoey whimpers, the sounds babies made when they were getting ready to give up and go to sleep. She folded the damp cloth over and then tucked the edges in, making a little envelope that reminded her of the seed packets her dad had gotten from the Burpee Company late each winter, back in the days when she had still been a regular attendee at Little Folk Sunday School. She had now grown comfortable enough with her nakedness to be exasperated by it rather than ashamed. She wanted a pocket. Well, if wishes were pigs, bacon would always be on set. The part of her that was practical and sensible realized what she was about to do with her rose matter-stained fingers less than a second before they would have been in her mouth. She snatched them away with her heart pounding and that sweet, tart smell filling her head. "Don't taste the fruit," Wendy had told her. "Don't taste the fruit or even put the hand that touches the seeds into your mouth." This place was full of traps. She got up, looking at her stained and tingling fingers, as if she had never seen them before. She backed away from the tree standing in its circle of fallen fruit and spilled seeds. It's not the tree of good and evil, Rosie thought. It's not the tree of life, either. I think this is the tree of death. A little gust of wind puffed past her, rustling through the pomegranate tree's long, polished leaves, and they seemed to rattle out her name in 100 small, sarcastic whispers. Rosie, Rosie, Rosie. She knelt again, wishing for live grass, but there was none. She put down her nightgown with the rock inside it, placed the little packet of seeds on top of it, then snatched up big handfuls of wet, dead grass. She scrubbed the hand which had touched the seeds as well as she could. The rose matter stain faded but didn't disappear completely, and it remained bright beneath her nails. It was like looking at a birthmark which nothing will completely bleach out. Meantime, the baby's cries were becoming ever more occasional. "Okay," Rosie muttered to herself, getting up. "Just keep your damn fingers out of your mouth. You'll be all right if you do that." She walked to the stairs which led beneath the white stone and stood at the head of them for a moment, dreading the darkness and trying to nerve herself up to face it. The alabaster stone with maize carved into its surface no longer looked like a plinth to her. It looked like a marker standing at the edge of a narrow, open grave. The baby was down there, though, whimpering as babies do when no one comes to comfort them, and they finally set about doing the job as well as they can themselves. It was that lonely, self-comforting sound which finally set her feet in motion. No baby should have to cry itself to sleep in such a lonely place. Rosie counted steps as she went down. At 7, she passed beneath the overhang in the stone. At 14, she looked over her shoulder at the white rectangle of light she was leaving behind. And when she faced forward again, that shape hung before her eyes in the screening darkness like a bright ghost. She went down and down, bare feet slapping on stone. There would be no talking herself out of the terror which now filled her heart, no talking herself through it, either. She would be doing well just to live with it. 50 steps, 75, 100. She stopped at 125, realizing she could see again. That's nuts, she thought. Imagination, Rosie, that's all. It wasn't, though. She raised a hand slowly toward her face. It and the little packet of seeds it held glowed a dull, witchy green. She raised her other hand, the one holding the rock and the remains of her nightgown beside it. She could see, all right. She turned her head first one way, then the other. The walls of the stairwell were glowing with a faint green light. Black shapes rose and twisted lazily in it, as if the walls were actually the glass faces of aquaria in which dead things twisted and floated. Stop it, Rosie, stop thinking that way. Except she couldn't. Dream or no dream, panic and blind retreat were now very close. Don't look then. Good idea. Great idea. Rosie dropped her eyes to the dim X-ray ghosts of her own feet and resumed her descent, now whispering her count under her breath. The green light continued to brighten as she went down, and by the time she reached 220, the last step, it was as if she were standing on a stage lit with low-level green gels. She looked up, trying to steel herself for what she might see. The air down here was moving, damp but fresh enough. Yet it brought her a smell she didn't much like. It was a zoo smell, as if something wild were penned up down here. Something was, of course, the bull Erinyes. Ahead were three freestanding stone walls, facing her edge on, and running away into the gloom. Each was about 12 feet high, much too tall for her to see over. They glowed with that sullen green light, and Rosie nervously examined the four narrow passages they made. Which one? Somewhere far ahead of her, the baby continued to whimper, but the sound was fading relentlessly. It was like listening to a radio which is being slowly but steadily turned down. Cry! Rosie shouted, then cringed from the returning echoes of her own voice. Hi! 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 Nothing. The four passages, the four entrances to the maze, gawped silently at her like narrow, vertical mouths wearing identical expressions of prissy shock. Not far inside the second from the right, she saw a dark pile of something. You know damned well what that is, she thought. After 14 years of listening to Norman and Harley and all their friends, you'd have to be pretty stupid not to know bullshit when you see it. This thought and the memories that went with it, memories of those men sitting around in the rec room, talking about the job and drinking beer and talking about the job and smoking cigarettes and talking about the job and telling jokes about niggers and spicks and taco benders and then talking about the job a little more, made her angry. Instead of denying the emotion, Rosie went against a lifetime of self-training and welcomed it. It felt good to be angry, to be anything other than terrified. As a kid, she'd had a really piercing playground yell, the sort of high, drilling cry that could shatter window glass and almost rupture eyeballs. She had been scolded and shamed out of using it around the age of 10, on the grounds that it was unladylike as well as brain-destroying. Now Rosie decided to see if she still had it in her repertoire. She drew the damp underground air into her lungs all the way to the bottom, closed her eyes, and remembered playing Capture the Flag behind Elm Street School or Red Rover and Texas Rangers in Billy Calhoun's jungly, overgrown backyard. For a moment she thought she could almost smell the comforting aroma of her favorite flannel shirt, the one she wore until it practically fell apart on her back. And then she peeled back her lips and let loose with the old, ululating, yodeling cry. She was delighted, almost ecstatic, when it came out sounding just as it had in the old days. But there was something even better. It made her feel the way it had in the old days, like a combination of Wonder Woman, Supergirl, and Annie Oakley. And it still affected others as it had back then, it seemed. The baby had begun to cry again, even before she had finished sending her schoolyard war whoop into the stony dark. It was, in fact, screaming at the top of its lungs. "Quick now, Rosie, you have to be. If she's really tired, she won't be able to manage that volume for very long." Rosie took a couple of steps forward, eyeing each of the four entrances to the maze, then walked past each of them, listening. The wail of the baby might have sounded a bit louder coming out of the third passageway. That could have been no more than imagination, but at least it was a place to begin. She started down it, bare feet slapping on the stone floor, then halted with her head cocked and her teeth working at her lower lip. Her old war cry had stirred up more than the baby, it seemed. Somewhere in here, how close or far away was impossible to tell because of the echo, hooves were running on rock. They moved at a lazy lope, seeming to grow closer, then fading a little, then growing closer again, then somehow this was more frightening than the sound itself, stopping altogether. She heard a low, wet snort. It was followed by an even lower grunting sound. Then there was only the baby, its bellows already beginning to subside again. Rosie found herself able to imagine the bull all too well, a vast animal with a bristly hide and thick black shoulders humping grimly above its dropped head. It would have a gold ring in its nose, of course, like the Minotaur in her childhood book of myths. And the green light sweating out of the walls would reflect off that ring in tiny stitches of liquid light. Erinyes was standing quietly now in one of the passages ahead, its horns tipped forward, listening for her, waiting for her. She walked down the faintly glowing corridor, trailing one hand along the wall, listening for the baby and the bull. She kept an eye out for more droppings, too, but saw none, not yet, anyway. After perhaps 3 minutes, the passage she was following emptied into a T-junction. The sound of the baby seemed slightly louder to the left. Or do I just have a dominant ear to match my dominant hand, she wondered. So she turned in that direction. She had taken only 2 steps when she stopped short. All at once she knew what the seeds were for. She was Gretel, underground, with no brother to share her fear. She went back to the T-junction, knelt, and unfolded one side of her packet. She placed a seed on the floor with the sharp end pointing back in the direction from which she had come. At least, she reflected, there were no birds down here to gobble up her back trail. Rosie got to her feet and began walking again. 5 paces brought her to a new passage. She peered down it and saw that it divided into 3 branches just a short way up. She chose the center branch, marking it with a pomegranate seed. 30 paces and 2 turns later, this passage dead-ended in a stone wall upon which 7 black words had been slashed. "Wanna do the dog with me?" Rosie returned to the 3-way junction, stooped to pick up her seed, and laid it at the head of a new path. She had no idea how long it took her to find her way to the center of the maze in this fashion, because time quickly lost all meaning for her. She knew it couldn't have taken terribly long because the baby's cries continued, although by the time Rosie began to get really close, they had become intermittent. 2 times she heard the bull's hooves go thudding dully along the stone floor, once at a distance, once so close that she stopped short, hands clasped between her breasts as she waited for it to appear at the head of the passageway she was in. If she had to backtrail, she always picked up the last seed, so she should suffer no confusion on her way back out. She had started with almost 50. When she finally came around a corner and observed a much brighter green glow straight ahead, she was down to 3. She walked to the end of the passageway and stood at its mouth, looking into a square, stone-floored room. She glanced out briefly, looking for a roof, and saw only a cavernous blackness that made her dizzy. She looked down again, registered several more large pats of dung scattered across the floor, and then turned her attention to the center of the room. Lying there on a pad of blankets was a plump, fair-haired baby. Her eyes were swollen with crying and her cheeks were wet with tears, but she had fallen quiet again, at least for the time being. Her feet were in the air and she appeared to be trying to examine her toes. Every now and then she gave out a watery, sobbing little gasp. These sounds moved Rosie's heart in a way the baby's all-out wails had not been able to do. It was as if the infant knew somehow that she had been abandoned. "Bring me my baby." Whose baby? Who is she, really? And who brought her here? She decided she didn't care about the answer to those questions, at least not now. It was enough that she was lying here, perfectly sweet and all alone, trying to comfort herself with her own toes in the chilly green light at the center of the maze. And that light can't be good for her, Rosie thought distractedly, hurrying toward the center of the room. Must be some kind of radiation. The baby turned her head, saw Rosie, and raised her arms toward her. The gesture won Rosie's heart completely. She wrapped the top blanket in the pile over the child's chest and belly, then picked her up. The infant looked to be about 3 months old. She put her arms around Rosie's neck and then dropped her head, clunk, down on Rosie's shoulder. She began to sob again, but very weakly. "That's all right," Rosie said, patting the tiny, blanket-wrapped back gently. She could smell the infant's skin, warm and sweeter than any perfume. She put her nose against the fine hair which floated around the perfectly made skull. "That's all right, Caroline. Everything's fine. We're going to get out of this nasty old..." She heard thudding hooves approaching from behind her and shut her mouth, praying that the bull hadn't heard her alien voice, praying that the hooves would turn and begin to fade as Arinyes chose some path that would lead it away from her again. This time, that didn't happen. The hoofbeats grew closer, sharper, too, as the bull closed in. Then they stopped, but she could hear something big breathing hard, like a heavy-set man who has just climbed a flight of stairs. Slowly, feeling old and stiff, Rosie turned toward the sound with the baby in her arms. She turned to Arinyes, and Arinyes was there.
"That bull would smell me and come running," that was what the woman in the red dress had told her, and something else. "It's me he'd come to, but both of us get killed."
Had Arinyes smelled her? Smelled her even though the moon was not full for her? Rosie didn't think so. She thought it was the bull's job to guard the baby, perhaps to guard whatever might be at the center of the maze, and that it had been drawn by the sound of the baby's cries, just as Rosie had been. Perhaps that mattered, perhaps it didn't. In any case, the bull was here, and it was the ugliest brute Rosie had ever seen in her life. It stood at the mouth of the passageway it had just run, somehow as unsettled in its shape as the temple she had passed through. It was as though she were looking at it through currents of clear, rapidly moving water. Yet the bull itself was, for the moment at least, completely still. Its head was lowered. One huge front hoof, cloven so deeply it almost looked like a gigantic bird's talon, pawed restlessly at the stone floor. Its shoulders overtopped Rosie's 5'6" by at least 4 inches, and she guessed its weight at 2 tons minimum. The top of its dropped head was flat as a hammer and shiny as silk. Its horns were stubby, no more than a foot in length, but sharp and thick. Rosie had no trouble imagining how easily they would punch into her naked belly, or into her back if she tried to run. She couldn't imagine how such a death would feel, however. Not even after all her years with Norman could she imagine that. The bull raised its head slightly, and she saw it did indeed have only one eye, a filmy blue thing, huge and freakish, above the center of its snout. As it lowered its head and began to thud its cloven hoof restlessly against the floor again, she understood something else as well. It was getting ready to charge. The baby let out an ear-splitting howl almost directly into Rosie's ear, making her jump. "Hush," she said, bouncing it up and down in her arms. "Hush, baby, no fear, no fear." But there was fear, plenty of it. The bull standing over there in its narrow slot of doorway was going to unzip her guts for her and decorate these peculiar glowing walls with them. She supposed they would look black against the green, like the shapes which occasionally seemed to twist deep in the stone. There was nothing in this center chamber to hide behind, not so much as a single pillar. And if she ran for the passage she'd come out of, the blind bull would hear her feet on the stone and cut her off before she had gotten halfway. It would gore her, toss her against the wall, gore her again, and then trample her to death. The baby as well, if she managed to keep hold of it.
One-eyed blind, but there ain't nothing wrong with his sense of smell.
Rosie stood watching it with wide eyes, mesmerized by the tapping front hoof. When that tapping finally stopped, she looked down at the damp, crumpled ball of nightgown in her hand, the ball of nightgown with the rag-wrapped stone in the center.
Nothing wrong with his sense of smell.
She dropped to one knee, keeping her eyes trained on the bull and holding the baby against her shoulder with her right hand. She used the left to open out her nightgown. The piece she had wrapped around the rock had been a dark red, rich with Wendy Yarrow's blood, but the downpour had washed much of it away, and the fabric was now a fading pink. Only the ears of cloth where she had tied it over the rock were brighter, were in fact rose madder. Rosie cupped the stone in her left hand, feeling the heft of it. Just as the bull's haunches flexed, she underhanded the stone, bowling it along the floor to the bull's left. Its head swung heavily in that direction, its nostrils flared, and it charged toward what it both heard and smelled. Rosie was on her feet again in a flash. She left the crumpled remnant of her nightgown lying beside the baby's pad of blankets. The little packet containing the last three pomegranate seeds was still in her hand, but Rosie wasn't aware of them. She was aware only of sprinting across the room toward the passageway she wanted, while behind her Arinyes charged the rock, kicked it aslant with one flying hoof, chased it down again, butted it with the flat hammer of its head, sent it flying into one of the other passages, and then chased after it, grunting thickly in its throat. She was sprinting, yes, but in slow motion. And now all this seemed like a dream again, because this was the way one always ran in dreams, especially the bad ones, where the fiend was always just two steps behind. In nightmares, escape became an underwater ballet. She burst into the narrow corridor just as she heard the hoofbeats wheel around and begin to approach again. They came fast, bearing down on her, and as they closed in, Rosie screamed and clutched the yowling, frightened baby to her breasts and ran for her life. It did no good. The bull was faster. It overtook her, and then passed by on the far side of the wall to her right. Arinyes had discovered the ruse of the stone in time to double back and catch her, but it had chosen the wrong passageway by one. Rosie hurried on, gasping, dry-mouthed, feeling the rapid rhythm of her heartbeat in her temples, her throat, her eyeballs. She hadn't the slightest idea of where she was or in which direction she was traveling. Now everything depended on the seeds. If she had forgotten so much as a single one, she might wander in here for hours until the bull finally found her and ran her down. She reached a five-way junction, looked down, and saw no seed. She did see a gleaming, aromatic spatter of bull piss, however, and it gave rise to a horribly plausible idea. Suppose there had been a seed. She couldn't remember dropping one here, true enough, so in itself the lack of one meant nothing. But she couldn't remember not dropping one either. Suppose she had, and suppose the bull had picked it up on its hoof as it raced through the intersection with its head down, and its short, sharp horns sorting through the air, spraying piss as it went. You can't think of that, Rosie. Plausible or not, you can't think of it. You'll freeze, and eventually the bull will kill both of you. She dashed across the intersection, holding the baby's neck with one hand, not wanting her head to go whipping back and forth. The passage ran straight on for 20 yards, made a right angle, then ran another 20 yards to a T-junction. She hurried down it, telling herself not to lose her head if she found no seed there. In that case, she would simply retrace her steps to the five-way and try another choice. Easy as pie, simple as could be, zero perspiration. If she kept her head, that was. And even as she was preparing herself with these thoughts, an alien, frightened voice at the back of her mind was moaning, "Lost, this is what you get for leaving your husband. This is how it all turns out, lost in the maze, playing hide-and-seek with a bull in the dark, doing errands for mad women.
This is what happens to bad wives, to wives who get above their place in the scheme of things, lost in the dark.
She saw the seed, its sharp end pointing clearly into the right-hand arm of the junction, and sobbed with relief. She kissed the baby's cheek and saw she had fallen asleep again. Rosie turned right and began walking with Caroline. It was as good a name as any, surely, cradled in her arms. She never quite lost that nightmarish floating feeling, nor her fear that she would eventually come to an intersection she had forgotten to mark with a seed. But at every choosing point, the seed was there. Arigny's was there too, however, and the thudding of his hooves on stone, sometimes far off and muffled, sometimes close and terrifyingly sharp, reminded her of the time she and her parents had gone to New York City when she had been only 5 or 6. The two things she remembered best about that trip were the Rockettes high-kicking their way across the stage at Radio City Music Hall, their legs moving in perfect unison, and the intimidating bustle and confusion of Grand Central Station, with its echoes and huge lighted signs and its tidal flows of people. The people in Grand Central had fascinated her as much as the Rockettes had, and for many of the same reasons, although this idea would not come to her until later. But the sound of the trains had scared her badly, because you couldn't tell where they were coming from or where they were going. The disembodied squeals and rumbles swelled and faded, sometimes distant, sometimes seeming to shake the very floor under one's feet. Listening to the bull Arigny's charge blindly through the maze brought that memory back with amazing clarity. Rosie understood that she, who had never wagered a single dollar on the state lottery, or played a single card of church bingo for a turkey or a set of glassware, was now running in a game of chance where the prize was her life, and the forfeit would be her death. And the baby's death, too. She thought of the man in Portside, the one with the handsome, unreliable face and the game of three-card Monty set up on top of his suitcase. Now she was the ace of spades. The cold fact was that the bull didn't necessarily need its ears or its sense of smell to find them. It might stumble upon them by dumb luck. But that didn't happen. Rosie came around a final corner and saw the stairs ahead. Gasping, crying, and laughing all at the same time, she hurried out of the passageway and ran for them. She climbed half a dozen, then turned and looked back. From here she could see the maze twisting and sprawling its way into the dimness, a right and left-angled confusion of turns, junctions, and blind alleys. Somewhere far off to the right she could hear Arigny's galloping, galloping away. They were safe from it, and Rosie's shoulders sagged in relief. The voice of Wendy filled her head. "Never mind that. You get on back here with the child. You done good, but you ain't done yet." No, she certainly was not. She had over 200 stairs to climb, this time with a child in her arms, and she was exhausted already. "One at a time, dear," Practical Sensible said. "That's how you have to do it, one step at a time." "Yes, yes, Miss P&S, queen of the 12-step philosophy." Rosie started up, one step at a time, looking over her shoulder from time to time and thinking, half-formed, "Can bulls climb stairs?" Dreadful thoughts, as the maze fell behind her. The baby grew heavier and heavier in her arms, as if some weird mathematical law had come into force here. The closer to the surface, the heavier the kid. She could see a star point of daylight above her, and she fixed her eyes on it. For a while it seemed to mock her, growing no closer at all as her breath came faster and the blood pounded in her temples. For the first time in almost 2 weeks, her kidneys really began to hurt again, throbbing in dull counterpoint to her laboring heart. She ignored all of these things, as well as she could anyway, and kept her eyes fixed on the star point. At last it began to swell and to take on the edge of the opening at the top of the stairs. 5 steps from the top, a paralyzing cramp sank into the big muscles of her right thigh, knotting the flesh from the back of her knee almost all the way up to her right buttock. When she reached down to massage her leg, it was at first like trying to knead stone. Groaning softly, her mouth pulled down in a trembling moo of pain, she worked on the muscles. This was something else she had done for herself many times during the years of her marriage, until they finally began to loosen. She flexed the leg at the knee, waiting to see if the cramp would seize her again. When it didn't, she cautiously climbed the last few stairs, favoring the leg as she went. At the top, she stood looking around with the dazed eyes of a miner who has, contrary to all his expectations, survived a terrible cave-in. The clouds had rolled away during her time underground, and the day was now filled with hazy summer light. The air was heavy and humid, but Rosie thought she had still never drawn a sweeter breath in her entire life. She turned her face, wet with sweat and tears, gratefully up to the faded blue denim she could see between the unraveling clouds. Somewhere in the distance, thunder continued to rumble balefully, like a beaten bully making empty threats. That made her think of Arinyes running in the darkness below, still looking for the woman who had invaded its domain and stolen its prize. "Cherchez la femme," Rosie thought with a trace of a smile. "You can chercher all you want, big fella. This femme, not to mention her petite fille, is gone." Rosie walked slowly away from the stairs. At the head of the path leading back into the grove of dead trees, she sat down with the baby in her lap. All she wanted was to regain her breath, but the hazy sun was warm on her back, and when she raised her head again, some small change in the lie of her shadow made her think she might have dozed a little. As she got to her feet, wincing at the pain that shot through the muscles of her right thigh, she heard the harsh, squabbling cry of many birds. They sounded like a big family having a rancorous argument at Sunday dinner. The child in her arms made a soft, snorting sound as Rosie shifted her to a more comfortable position, blew a little spit bubble between her pursed lips, then fell silent again. Rosie was both amused by and deeply envious of her placid, sleeping confidence. She started down the path, then stopped and looked back at the single living tree with its shiny green leaves, its bounty of deadly reddish-purple fruit, and the classical fable subway entrance standing nearby. She looked at these things for a long moment, filling her eyes and mind with them. "They're real," she thought. "How can things I see so clearly be anything but real? And I dozed off, I know I did. How can you go to sleep in a dream? How can you go to sleep when you're sleeping already?" "Forget it," Practical Sensible said. "That's the best thing, at least for the time being." Yes, probably it was. Rosie started off again, and when she reached the fallen tree blocking the path, she was amused and rather exasperated to see that her arduous detour around the snarl of roots could have been avoided. There was an easy path around the top of the tree. "At least there is now," she thought as she went around it. "Are you sure there was before, Rosie?" The rocky babble of the black stream rose in her ears, and when she reached it, she saw that the level had already begun to drop, and the stepping stones no longer looked so perilously small. Now they looked almost the size of floor tiles, and the scent of the water had lost its ominously attractive quality. Now it just smelled like very hard water, the kind that would leave an orange ring around the tub and toilet bowl. The squabble of the birds, "You did! No, I didn't. Yes, you did," started up again, and she observed 20 or 30 of the largest birds she had ever seen in her life lined up along the peak of the temple's roof. They were much too big to be crows, and after a moment she decided they were this world's version of buzzards or vultures. But where had they come from? And why were they here? Without realizing she was doing it until the infant squirmed and protested in her sleep, Rosie hugged the baby tighter to her breast as she gazed at the birds. They all took off at the same instant, their wings flapping like sheets on a clothesline. It was as if they had seen her looking at them and didn't like it. Most of them flew off to roost in the dead trees behind her, but several remained in the hazy sky overhead, circling like bad omens in a Western movie. Where did they come from? What do they want? More questions to which Rosie had no answers. She pushed them away and crossed the stream on the stones. As she approached the temple, she saw a neglected but faintly visible path leading around its stone flank. Rosie took it without a single moment of interior debate, although she was naked and both sides of the path were lined with thorn bushes. She walked carefully, turning sideways to keep her hip from being scratched, holding, Caroline, the baby, up and out of Thorn's way. Rosie took one or two swipes in spite of her care, but only one, across her badly used right thigh, was deep enough to draw blood. As she came around the corner of the temple and glanced up at the front, it seemed to her that the building had changed somehow, and that the change was so fundamental that she wasn't quite able to grasp it. She forgot the idea for a moment in her relief at seeing Wendy, still standing beside the fallen pillar. But after she'd taken half a dozen steps toward the woman in the red dress, Rosie stopped and looked back, opening her eyes to the building, opening her mind to it. This time she saw the change at once, and a little grunt of surprise escaped her. The Temple of the Bull now looked stiff and unreal, two-dimensional. It made Rosie think of a line of poetry she'd read back in high school, something about a painted ship upon a painted ocean. The odd, unsettling sense that the temple was out of perspective, or inhabiting some strange non-Euclidean universe where all the laws of geometry were different, had departed, and the building's aura of menace had departed with it. Now its lines looked straight in all the places where one expected such a building to look straight. There were no sudden turns or jags in the architecture to trouble the eye. The building looked, in fact, like a painting, rendered by an artist whose mediocre talent and run-of-the-mill romanticism have combined to create a piece of bad art. The sort of picture which always seems to end up gathering dust in a basement corner or on an attic shelf, along with old issues of the National Geographic and stacks of jigsaw puzzles with a piece or two missing. Or in the seldom-browsed third aisle of a pawn shop, perhaps.
Woman? You, woman!
She swung back toward Wendy and saw her beckoning impatiently.
Hurry up and get that baby over here. This ain't no tourist traction.
Rosie ignored her. She had risked her life for this child, and she didn't intend to be hurried. She folded back the blanket and looked at a body which was as naked and female as her own. That was where the resemblance ended, however. There were no scars on the child, no marks that looked like the fading teeth of old traps. There was not, as far as Rosie could see, so much as a single mole on that small and lovely body. She traced a finger slowly up the baby's entire length, from ball of ankle to ball of hip to ball of shoulder. Perfect. Yes, perfect. And now that you have risked your life for her, Rosie, now that you've saved her from the dark and the bull and God knows what else that might have been down there, do you intend to turn her over to these two women? Both have some sort of disease working on them, and the one up on the hill has a mental problem as well, a serious mental problem. Do you intend to give this kid to them?
She'd be all right, the brown-skinned woman said.
Rosie wheeled in the direction of the voice. Wendy Yarrow was now standing at her shoulder and looking at Rosie with perfect understanding.
Yes, she said, nodding as if Rosie had spoken her doubts aloud. I know what you're thinking, and I tell you, it's all right. She mad, no doubt in the world about that, but her madness don't extend to the child. She knows that although she bore it, this child ain't hers to keep, no more than it's yours to keep.
Rosie glanced toward the hill where she could just see the woman in the chiton standing by the pony and waiting for the outcome. What's her name? She asked. The baby's mother. Is it?
Never mind,
the brown woman in the red dress replied, cutting in quickly, as if to keep Rosie from speaking some word better left unsaid.
Her name don't matter. Her state of mind does. She a mighty impatient lady these days, along with her other woes. We best be going up with no more jabber.
Rosie said, I'd made up my mind to call my baby Caroline. Norman said I could. He didn't really care one way or the other. She began to cry.
Seems like a nice enough name to me. A fine name. Don't you cry now. Don't you carry on.
She slipped an arm around Rosie's shoulders, and they began walking up the hill. The grass whispered gently against Rosie's bare legs and tickled her knees.
Will you listen to a piece of my advice, woman?
Rosie looked at her curiously.
I know advice is hard to take in matters of sorrow, but think about my qualifications to give it. I was born in slavery, raised in chains, and ransomed to freedom by a woman who's not quite a goddess. Her,
she pointed to the woman who stood silently watching and waiting for them.
She's drunk the waters of youth, and she made me drink, too. Now we go on together, and I don't know about her, but sometimes when I look in the mirror, I wish for wrinkles. I've buried my children and their children and their children's children into the fifth generation. I've seen wars come and go like waves on a beach that roll in and rub out the footprints and wash away the castles in the sand. I've seen bodies on fire and heads by the hundreds poked onto poles along the streets of the city of Lud. I've seen wise leaders assassinated and fools put up in their places. And still I live.
She sighed deeply.
Still I live, and if there's anything that qualifies me to give advice, it's that. Will you hear it? Answer quick. It's not advice I'd have her over here, and we're drawing close.
Yes, tell me, Rosie said.
It's best to be ruthless with the past. It ain't the blows we're dealt that matter, but the ones we survive. Now remember, for your sanity's sake, if not your life's, don't look at her.
The woman in red spoke these last words in an emphatic little mutter. Less than a minute later, Rosie was once more standing in front of the blonde woman. She fixed her eyes firmly on the hem of Rose Matter's chiton, and she didn't realize she was clutching the baby too tightly again until Caroline wriggled in her arms and waved an indignant arm. The child had awakened and was looking up at Rosie with bright interest. Her eyes were the same hazy blue as the summer sky overhead.
You've done well, so you have, that low and sweetly husky voice told her. I thank you. Now give her to me.
Rose Matter held out her hands. They swarmed with shadows. And now Rosie saw something she liked even less. A thick, gray-green sludge was growing between the woman's fingers like moss or scales. Without thinking about what she was doing, Rosie held the baby against her. This time she wriggled more strongly and voiced a short cry.
A brown hand reached out and squeezed Rosie's shoulder. It's all right, I tell you. She'd never heard it, and I'll have most the care of it until our journey's done. That won't be long, and then she'll turn the child over to... Well, that part don't matter. For a little while longer, the baby's hers. Give it over now.
Feeling it was the hardest thing she'd ever had to do in a life full of hard things, Rosie held out the baby. There was a soft little grunt of satisfaction as the shadowy hands took her. The baby gazed up into the face which Rosie was forbidden to look at, and laughed.
Yes, yes,
the sweet, husky voice crooned, and there was something in it like Norman's smile, something that made Rosie feel like screaming.
Yes, sweet one. It was dark, wasn't it? Dark and nasty and bad. Oh, yes, Mama knows.
The mottled hands lifted the baby against the Rose Matter gown. The child looked up, smiled, then laid her head on her mother's breast and closed her eyes again.
Rosie,
the woman in the chiton said. Her voice was musing, thoughtful.
Insane.
The voice of a despot who will soon seize personal control of imaginary armies.
Yes,
Rosie nearly whispered.
Really, Rosie. Rosie real.
Yes, I guess.
Do you remember what I told you before you went down?
Yes, Rosie said. I remember very well. She wished she didn't.
What was it?
Rose Matter asked greedily.
What did I tell you, Rosie Real?
I repay.
Yes, I repay. Was it bad for you down in the dark? Was it bad for you, Rosie Real?
She thought this over carefully. Bad, but not the worst. I think the worst was the stream. I wanted to drink.
There are many things in your life that you would forget?
Yes, I guess there are.
Your husband?
She nodded. The woman with the sleeping baby against her breast spoke with a queer, flat assurance that chilled Rosie's heart.
You shall be divorced of him.
Rosie opened her mouth, found herself quite incapable of speech, and closed it again.
Men are beasts, Rose Matter said conversationally. Some can be gentled and then trained. Some cannot. When we come upon one who cannot be gentled and trained, a rogue, should we feel that we have been cursed or cheated? Should we sit by the side of the road or in a rocking chair by the bed, for that matter, bewailing our fate? Should we rage against Ka? No, for Ka is the wheel that moves the world, and the man or woman who rages against it will be crushed under its rim. But rogue beasts must be dealt with, and we must go about that task with hopeful hearts, for the next beast may always be different.
Bill isn't a beast, Rosie thought, and she knew she would never dare say that aloud to this woman. It was too easy to imagine this woman seizing her and tearing her throat out with her teeth.
In any case, beasts will fight, Rose Matter said. That is their way. To lower their heads and rush at each other so they may try their horns. Do you understand?
Rosie suddenly thought she did understand what the woman was saying, and it terrified her. She raised her fingers to her mouth and touched her lips. They felt dry, feverish. There isn't going to be any fight, she said. There isn't going to be any fight because they don't know about each other.
Beasts will fight. Rose Matter repeated, and then held something out to Rosie.
It took her a moment to realize what it was, the gold armlet she'd been wearing above her right elbow.
I can't.
Take it, the woman in the chiton said with sudden, harsh impatience. Take it, and don't whine any more. For the sake of every god that ever was, stop your stupid sheep's whining.
Rosie reached out with a trembling hand and took the armlet. Although it had been against the blonde woman's flesh, it felt cold. If she asks me to put it on, I don't know what I'll do, Rosie thought.
But Rose Matter did not ask her to put it on. Instead, she reached out with her mottled hand and pointed toward the olive tree. The easel was gone, and the picture, like the one in her room, had grown to an enormous size. It had changed as well. It still showed the room on Tremont Street, but now there was no woman facing the door. The room was in darkness. Just a fluff of blonde hair and a single bare shoulder showed above the blanket on the bed.
That's me, Rosie thought in wonder. That's me sleeping and having this dream.
Go on, Rose Matter said, and touched the back of her head. Rosie took a step toward the picture, mostly to get away from even the lightest touch of that cold and awful hand. As she did, she realized she could hear, very faintly, the sound of traffic. Crickets jumped around her feet and ankles in the high grass.
Go on, little Rosie Real. Thank you for saving my baby.
Our baby, Rosie said, and was instantly horrified. A person who corrected this woman had to be insane herself. But the woman in the reddish-purple chiton sounded amused rather than angry when she replied,
Yes, yes, if you like, our baby. Go on now. Remember what you have to remember, and forget what you need to forget. Protect yourself while you're outside the circle of my regard.
You bet, Rosie thought. And I won't be coming around looking for favors, you can count on it. That would be like hiring Idi Amin to cater a garden party, or Adolf Hitler to— The thought broke off as she saw the woman in the painting shift in her bed and pull the blanket up over her exposed shoulder. Not
a painting, not anymore. A window.
Go on, the woman in the red dress said softly. You done fine. Get gone before she change her mind about how she feel.
Rosie stepped toward the picture, and from behind her, Rose Matter spoke again. Her voice neither sweet nor husky now, but loud and harsh and murderous. And remember, I repay! Rosie's eyes winced shut at this unexpected shout, and she lunged forward, suddenly sure that the woman in the chiton had forgotten the service Rosie had done her, and had decided to kill her after all. She tripped over something, the bottom edge of the painting, perhaps, and then there was a sense of falling. She had time to feel her stomach turn over like a circus tumbler, and then there was only darkness, rushing past her eyes and ears. In it, she seemed to hear some ominous sound, distant but drawing closer. Perhaps it was the sound of trains in the deep tunnels beneath Grand Central Station. Perhaps it was the rumble of thunder. Or perhaps it was the bull, Arinyes, running the blind depths of his maze with his head down and his short, sharp horns sorting the air. Then, for a little while at least, Rosie knew nothing at all. She floated silently and thoughtlessly, like an undreaming embryo in its placental sack, until 7 o'clock in the morning. Then the Big Ben beside the bed tore her out of sleep with its ruthless howl. Rosie sat bolt upright, flailing at the air with hands like claws, and crying out something she didn't understand, words from a dream that was already forgotten. Don't make me look at you! Don't make me look at you! Don't make me! Don't make me! Then she saw the cream-colored walls, and a sofa that was really just a love seat with delusions of grandeur, and the light flooding in through the window, and used these things to lock in the reality she needed. Whoever she might have been, or wherever she might have gone in her dreams, she was now Rosie McClendon, a single woman who recorded audiobooks for a living. She had stayed for a long time with a bad man, but had left him and met a good one. She lived in a room at 897 Trenton Street, second floor, end of the hall, good view of Bryant Park. Oh, and one other thing. She was a single woman who never intended to eat another foot-long hot dog in her life, especially one smothered in sauerkraut. They did not agree with her, it seemed. She couldn't remember what she had dreamed. Remember what you have to remember and forget what you need to forget. But she knew how it had started. With her walking into that damned painting, like Alice going through the looking glass. Rosie sat where she was for a moment, wrapping herself in her rosy real world as firmly as she could, then reached out for the relentless alarm clock. Instead of gripping it, she knocked it onto the floor. It lay there, bawling its excited, senseless cry.
"Hire the handicapped. It's fun to watch 'em," she croaked.
She leaned over and groped for the clock, fascinated all over again by the blonde hair she saw from the corner of her eye, locks so fabulously unlike those of that obedient little creep mouse, Rose Daniels. She got hold of the clock, felt with her thumb for the stud that shut off the alarm, and then paused as something else registered. The breast pressing against her right forearm was naked. She silenced the alarm, then sat up with the clock still in her left hand. She pushed down the sheet and light blanket. Her bottom half was as bare as her top half. "Where's my nightie?" she asked the empty room. She thought she had never heard herself sounding so exceptionally stupid, but, of course, she wasn't used to going to bed with her nightgown on and waking up naked. Even 14 years of marriage to Norman had not prepared her for anything quite that peculiar.
She put the clock back on the night table, swung her legs out of bed.
Ow!
She cried, both startled and frightened by the pain and stiffness in her hips and thighs. Even her butt hurt.
Ow, ow, ow!
She sat on the edge of the bed and gingerly flexed her right leg, then her left. They moved, but they hurt, especially the right one. It was